4. Little by little, Beverly got herself under control again. She knew she had to get out. Beating a retreat was ultimately less dangerous than hanging around. They were absorbed in what they were doing, and even if worst came to worst, she could get a head start. And in the back of her mind, she had also decided that if worst came to terrible, a few shots from the bullseye might discourage them. She was about to begin creeping away when Victor said, "I gotta go, Henry. My dad wants me to help him pick corn this afternoon." "Oh, shit," Henry said. "He'll live." "No, he's mad at me because of what happened the other day." "Fuck him if he can't take a joke." Beverly listened more closely now, suspecting it might be the scuffle which had ended with Eddie's broken arm that they were talking about. "No, I gotta go." "I think his ass hurts," Patrick said. "Watch your mouth, fuckface," Victor said. "It might grow on you." "I got to go, too," Belch said. "Your father want you to pick corn?" Henry asked angrily. This was what might have passed for a jest in Henry's mind. Belch's father was dead. "No, but I got a job delivering the weekly shopper. I got to do that tonight." "What's this weekly shopper crap?" Henry asked, now sounding upset as well as angry. "It's a job," Belch said with ponderous patience. "I make money." Henry made a disgusted sound, and Beverly risked another peek around the car. Victor and Belch were standing, buckling their belts. Henry and Patrick were still squatting with their pants down. The lighter glinted in Henry's hand. "You're not chickening out, are you?" Henry asked Patrick. "Nope," Patrick said. "You don't have to pick corn or go do some pussy job." "Nope," Patrick said again. "Well," Belch said uncertainly, "see you around, Henry." "Sure," Henry said, and spat near one of Belch's clod-hopping work shoes. Vic and Belch started off together toward the two rows of wrecked cars, toward the Studebaker behind which Beverly was crouching. At first she could only cringe, frozen with fear like a rabbit. Then she slid around the left side of the Studebaker and back down the gap between it and the battered doorless Ford next to it. For a moment she paused, looking from side to side, hearing them approach. She hesitated, her mouth cottony dry, her back itchy with sweat. A part of her mind was numbly wondering how she'd look in a cast like Eddie's with the loser's name signed on it. Then she dived into the Ford on the passenger side. She curled up on the filthy floor mat, making herself as small as possible. It was boiling hot inside the junked-out Ford, and it smelled so thickly of dust, rotting upholstery, and elderly rat crap that she had to struggle grimly to keep from sneezing or coughing. She heard Belch and Victor pass close by, talking in low voices. Then they were gone. She sneezed 3 times, quickly and quietly, into her cupped hands. She supposed she could go now if she was careful. The best way to do it would be to shift over to the driver's side of the Ford, sneak back to the aisle, and then just do a fade. She believed she could manage it, but the shock of almost being discovered had robbed her of her courage, at least for the time being. She felt safer here in the Ford. And maybe now that Victor and Belch had gone, the other two would also go soon. Then she could go back to the clubhouse. She had lost all interest in target shooting. Also, she had to pee. "Come on," she thought. "Come on, hurry up and go, hurry up and go. Please." A moment later, she heard Patrick roar with mixed laughter and pain. 6 feet, Henry bellowed. "Just like a fucking blowtorch, swear to God." Silence then for a while. Sweat trickling down her back. The sun beating through the Ford's cracked windshield on the nape of her neck. Heaviness in her bladder. Henry bellowed so loud that Beverly, who had been close to dozing in spite of her discomfort, almost cried out herself. "Damn it, Hockstetter. You burned my frigging ass. What are you doing with that lighter?" 10 feet, Patrick giggled. Just the sound of it made Bev feel cold and revolted, as if she had seen a worm squirm its way out of her salad. 10 feet if it was an inch, Henry. Bright blue. 10 feet if it was an inch. Swear to God. Give me that, Henry grunted. Come on, you stupid nicks. Go, get out. When Patrick spoke again, his voice was so low Bev could barely hear it. If there had been the slightest breath of wind on the air that baking afternoon, she would not have done.
Let me show you something, Patrick said.
What? Henry asked.
Just something.
Patrick paused. It feels good.
What?
Henry asked again. Then there was silence.
I don't want to look. I don't want to see what they're doing now. And besides, they might see me. In fact, they probably will because you've used up all your luck today, girlio. so just stay right here. No peeking.
But her curiosity had overcome her good sense. There was something strange in that silence, something a little bit scary. She raised her head inch by inch until she could look through the Ford's cracked, cloudy windshield. She needn't have worried about being seen. Both of the boys were concentrating on what Patrick was doing. She didn't understand what she was seeing, but she knew it was nasty. Not that she would have expected anything else from Patrick, who was just so weird. He had one hand between Henry's thighs and one hand between his own. One hand was flogging Henry's thing gently. With his other hand, Patrick was rubbing his own. Except he wasn't exactly rubbing it. He was kind of squeezing it, pulling it, letting it flop back down. What is he doing? Beverly wondered, dismayed. She didn't know, not for sure, but it scared her. She didn't think she had been this scared since the blood had vomited out of the bathroom drain and splattered all over everything. Some deep part of her cried out that if they discovered she had seen this, whatever it was, they might do more than hurt her. They might actually kill her. Still, she couldn't look away. She saw that Patrick's thing had gotten a little longer, but not much. It still dangled between his legs like a snake with no backbone. Henry's, however, had grown amazingly. It stood up stiff and hard, almost poking his belly button. Patrick's hand went up and down, sometimes pausing to squeeze, sometimes tickling that odd heavy sack under Henry's thing.
Those are his balls, Beverly thought. Do boys have to go around with those all the time? God, I go crazy.
Another part of her mind then whispered,
Bill has those.
On its own, her mind visualized her holding them, cupping them in her hand, testing their texture, and that hot feeling raced through her again, sparking off a furious blush. Henry stared at Patrick's hand as if hypnotized. His lighter lay on the rocky scree beside him, reflecting hot afternoon sun.
Want me to put it in my mouth? Patrick asked. His big livery lips smiled complacently.
Huh? Henry asked, as if startled from some deep dream.
I'll put it in my mouth if you want.
Henry's hand flashed out, half-curled, not quite a fist. Patrick was knocked sprawling. His head thudded on the gravel. Beverly dived down again, her heart crashing in her chest, her teeth locked against a little whimpering moan. After knocking Patrick down, Henry had turned, and for a moment, just before she dropped back into her little huddled ball on the passenger side of the drive shaft hump, it seemed that her eyes and Henry's had locked.
Please God, the sun was in his eyes, she prayed. Please God, I'm sorry I peeked. Please God.
There was an agonizing pause then. Her white blouse was plastered to her body with sweat. Droplets like seed pearls gleamed on her tanned arms. Her bladder throbbed painfully. She felt that very soon she would wet her pants. She waited for Henry's furious, crazy face to appear in the opening where the Ford's passenger door had been, sure it was going to happen. How could he have missed seeing her? He would drag her out and hurt her. He would... A new and even more terrible thought now occurred to her, and once again she had to engage in a painful, crampy struggle to keep from wetting her pants. Suppose he did something to her with his thing. Suppose he wanted her to put it in her somewhere. She knew where it was supposed to go, all right. It seemed that knowledge had suddenly sprung into her mind full-blown. She thought that if Henry tried to put his thing in her, she would go crazy.
Please, no, please, God, don't let him have seen me, please, okay?
Then Henry spoke, and to her growing horror, his voice was coming from someplace much closer. I don't go for that queer stuff. From farther off, Patrick's voice.
You liked it.
I didn't like it, Henry shouted. And if you tell anyone I did, I'll kill you, you fucking little pansy.
You got a boner, Patrick said.
He sounded like he was smiling. As much as she feared Henry Bowers, the smile would not have surprised Beverly. Patrick was crazy, crazier than Henry, maybe, and people that crazy weren't afraid of anything.
I saw it.
Footsteps crunched over the gravel, closer and closer. Beverly looked up, her eyes bulging. Through the Ford's old windshield, she could now see the back of Henry's head. He was looking toward Patrick now, but if he turned around...
If you tell anyone, I'll say you're a cocksucker, Henry said. Then I'll kill you.
You don't scare me, Henry, Patrick said and giggled. But I might not tell if you gave me a dollar.
Henry shifted restlessly. He turned slightly. Beverly could now see one quarter of his profile instead of just the back of his head.
Please, God, please, God,
she begged incoherently, and her bladder throbbed more strongly.
If you tell, Henry said, his voice low and deliberate, I'll tell what you've been doing with the cats, with the dogs, too. I'll tell them about your refrigerator. You know what'll happen, Hochstetter? They'll come and take you away and put you into the fucking A loony bin. Silence from Patrick. Henry drummed his fingers on the hood of the Ford Beverly was hiding in. Do you hear me? I hear you. Patrick sounded sullen now, sullen and a little scared. He burst out, You liked it. You got a boner. Biggest boner I ever saw. Yeah, I bet you've seen a lot of them, you fucking little homo faggot. You just remember what I said about the refrigerator. Your refrigerator. And if I see you around again, I'll knock your block off. More silence from Patrick. Henry moved away. Beverly turned her head and saw him pass by the driver's side of the Ford. If he had looked to his left even a little bit, he would have seen her. But he didn't look. A moment later, she heard him heading off the way Victor and Belch had gone. Now there was just Patrick. Beverly waited, but nothing happened. 5 minutes dragged by. Her need to urinate was now desperate. She might be able to hold out for another 2 or 3 minutes, but no more. And it made her uneasy not to know for sure where Patrick was. She peeked through the windshield again and saw him just sitting there. Henry had forgotten his lighter. Patrick had put his school books back into a small canvas carrier sack and had slung it around his neck like a newsboy's, but his pants and underpants were still down around his ankles. He was playing with the lighter. He would spin the wheel, produce a flame that was almost invisible in the bright day, snap the lighter closed, and then start all over again. He seemed hypnotized. A line of blood ran from the corner of his mouth to his chin, and his lips were swelling up on the right side. He seemed not to notice, and once again Beverly felt a squirmy sort of revulsion. Patrick was crazy, all right. She had never in her life wanted so badly to get away from someone. Moving very carefully, she crawled backward over the Ford's drive shaft hump and squeezed under the steering wheel. She put her feet out on the ground and crept to the back of the Ford. Then she ran quickly back the way she had come. When she had entered the pines beyond the junked cars, she looked back over her shoulder. No one was there. The dump dozed in the sun. She felt the bands of tension around her chest and stomach loosen with relief, and all that was left was the need to urinate, so great that she now felt sick with it. She hurried down the path a short way and then ducked off to the right. She had her shorts unsnapped almost before the underbrush had closed behind her again. She took a quick look around to make sure there was no poison ivy at hand. Then she squatted, holding the tough trunk of a bush for balance. She was pulling her shorts up again when she heard approaching footsteps from the dump. All she could see through the bushes were flashes of blue denim and the faded plaid of a school shirt. It was Patrick. She ducked down, waiting for him to pass by toward Kansas Street. She was more sanguine about her position here. The cover was good, she no longer had to pee, and Patrick was off in his own cuckoo world. When he was gone, she would double back and head for the clubhouse. But Patrick didn't pass by. He stopped on the path almost directly opposite her and stood looking at the rusting Amana refrigerator. Beverly could observe Patrick along a natural sight line in the bushes without too much chance of being seen. Now that she was relieved, she found she was curious again, and if Patrick did happen to see her, she felt certain she could outrun him. He wasn't as fat as Ben, but he was podgy. She pulled the bullseye out of her back pocket, however, and put half a dozen steel pellets in the breast pocket of her old Ship and Shore. Crazy or not, a good one to the knee might discourage the likes of Patrick Hochstetter in a hurry. She remembered the refrigerator well enough now. There were lots of discarded fridges at the dump, but it suddenly occurred to her that this was the only one she'd seen which Mandy Fazio hadn't disarmed by either tearing out the latching mechanism with pliers or simply removing the door altogether. Patrick began to hum and sway back and forth in front of the rusty old refrigerator, and Beverly felt a fresh chill course through her. He was like a guy in a horror movie trying to summon a dead body out of a crypt. What's he up to? But if she had known that, or what was going to happen when Patrick finished his private ritual and opened the dead Amana's rusty door, she would have run away as fast as she could. 5. No one, not even Mike Hanlon, had the slightest idea of how crazy Patrick Hochstetter really was. He was 12, the son of a paint salesman. His mother was a devout Catholic who would die of breast cancer in 1962, 4 years after Patrick was consumed by the dark entity which existed in and below Derry. Although his IQ tested out as low normal, Patrick had already repeated 2 grades, the first and third. He was taking summer classes this year, so he would not have to repeat the fifth as well. His teachers found him an apathetic student. This several of them noted on the bare 6 lines of the Derry Elementary School's report cards reserved for teachers' comments. And a rather disturbing one as well, which none noted. Their feelings were too vague, too diffuse, to be expressed in 60 lines, let alone 6. If he had been born 10 years later, a guidance counselor might have steered him toward a child psychologist who might, or might not, Patrick was far more clever than his lackluster IQ results indicated, have realized the frightening depths behind that slack and pallid moon face. He was a sociopath, and perhaps by that hot July in 1958, he had become a full-fledged psychopath. He could not remember a time when he had believed that other people, any other living creatures for that matter, were real. He believed himself to be an actual creature, probably the only one in the universe, but was by no means convinced that his actuality made him real. He had no sense of hurting exactly, and no real sense of being hurt. His indifference to being struck in the mouth by Henry in the dump was a case in point. But while he found reality a totally meaningless concept, he understood the concept of rules perfectly. And while all of his teachers had found him odd, both Mrs. Douglas, his fifth grade teacher, and Mrs. Weems, who had had Patrick in the third grade, knew about the pencil box full of flies, and while neither of them totally ignored the implications, each had between 20 and 28 other students, each with problems of his or her own. None of them had serious disciplinary problems with him. He might turn in test papers that were utterly blank, or blank except for a large decorative question mark. And Mrs. Douglas had discovered it was best to keep him away from the girls because of his Roman hands and Russian fingers. But he was quiet, so quiet that there were times when he might have been taken for a big lump of clay that had been crudely fashioned to look like a boy. It was easy to ignore Patrick, who failed quietly, when you had to cope with boys like Henry Bowers and Victor Chris, who were actively disruptive and insolent, boys who would steal milk money or happily deface school property if given a chance, and girls like the unfortunately named Elizabeth Taylor, who was epileptic and whose few poor brain cells worked only sporadically, and who had to be discouraged from pulling her dresses up in the play yard to show off a new pair of panties. In other words, Derry Elementary School was the typical confused educational carnival, a circus with so many rings that Pennywise himself might have gone unnoticed. Certainly none of Patrick's teachers, or his parents for that matter, suspected that when he was 5, Patrick had murdered his baby brother Avery. Patrick had not liked it when his mother brought Avery home from the hospital. He didn't care, or so he at first told himself, if his parents had 2 kids, 5 kids, or 5 dozen kids, as long as the kid or kids didn't alter his own schedule. But he found that Avery did. Meals came late. The baby cried in the night and woke him up. It seemed that his parents were always hanging over its crib, and often when he tried to get their attention, he found that he could not. For one of the few times in his life, Patrick became frightened. It occurred to him that if his parents had brought him, Patrick, home from the hospital, and if he was real, then Avery might be real too. It might even be that, when Avery got big enough to walk and talk, to bring in his father's copy of the Derry News from the front step, and to hand his mother the bowls when she baked bread, they might decide to get rid of Patrick altogether. It was not that he feared they loved Avery more, although it was obvious to Patrick that they did love him more, and in this case his judgment was probably correct. What he cared about was, 1, the rules that were being broken or had changed since Avery's arrival, 2, Avery's possible reality, and 3, the possibility that they might throw him out in favor of Avery. Patrick went into Avery's room one afternoon around 2:30, shortly after the school bus had dropped him off from his afternoon kindergarten session. It was January. Outside, snow was beginning to fall. A powerful wind boomed across McCarran Park and rattled the frosty upstairs storm windows. His mother was napping in her bedroom. Avery had been fussy all the previous night. His father was at work. Avery was sleeping on his stomach, his head turned to one side. Patrick, his moon face expressionless, turned Avery's head so his face was pressed directly into the pillow. Avery made a snuffling noise and turned his head back to the side. Patrick observed this and stood thinking about it while the snow melted off his yellow boots and puddled on the floor. Perhaps 5 minutes passed. Quick thinking was not Patrick's specialty. And then he turned Avery's face into the pillow again and held it there for a moment. Avery stirred under his hand, struggling, but his struggles were weak. Patrick let go. Avery turned his head to the side again, made one snorting little cry, and then went on sleeping. The wind gusted, rattling the windows. Patrick waited to see if the one little cry would awaken his mother. It didn't. Now he felt swept by a great excitement. The world seemed to stand out in front of him clearly for the first time. His emotional equipment was severely defective, and in those few moments he felt as a totally colorblind person might feel if given a shot which enabled him to perceive colors for a short time. Or as a junkie who has just fixed feels as the smack rockets his brain into orbit. This was a new thing. He had not suspected it existed. Very gently, he turned Avery's face into the pillow again. This time when Avery struggled, Patrick did not let go. He pressed the baby's face more firmly into the pillow. The baby was making steady, muffled cries now, and Patrick knew it was awake. He had a vague idea that it might tell on him to his mother if he stopped. He held it down. The baby struggled. Patrick held it down. The baby farted. Its struggles weakened. Patrick still held it down. It eventually became totally still. Patrick held it down for another 5 minutes, feeling that excitement crest and then begin to ebb. The shot wearing off, turning the world gray again, the fix mellowing into an accustomed low doze. Patrick went downstairs and got himself a plate of cookies and poured himself a glass of milk. His mother came down half an hour later and said she hadn't even heard him come in. She had been that tired. "You won't be any more, Mom," Patrick thought. "Don't worry, I fixed it." She sat down with him, ate one of his cookies, and asked him how school had been. Patrick said it was all right and showed her his drawing of a house and a tree. His paper was covered with looping, meaningless scribbles made with black and brown crayon. His mother said it was very nice. Patrick brought home the same looping scrawls of black and brown every day. Sometimes he said it was a turkey, sometimes a Christmas tree, sometimes a boy. His mother always told him it was very nice, although sometimes, in a part of her so deep she hardly knew it was there, she worried. There was something a little disquieting about the dark sameness of those big scribbled loops of black and brown. She didn't discover Avery's death until nearly 5 o'clock. Until then, she had simply assumed he was taking a very long nap. By then, Patrick was watching Crusader Rabbit on their 7-inch TV, and he went on watching TV through all the uproar that followed. Whirlybirds was on when Mrs. Henley arrived from next door. His screaming mother had been holding the baby's corpse in the open kitchen door, believing in some blind way that the cold air might revive it. Patrick was cold and got a sweater out of the downstairs closet. Highway Patrol, Ben Hanscom's favorite, was on when Mr. Hochstetter arrived home from work. By the time the doctor arrived, Science Fiction Theater, with your host Truman Bradley, was just coming on. "Who knows what strange things the universe may hold," Truman Bradley speculated, while Patrick's mother shrieked and struggled in her husband's arms in the kitchen. The doctor observed Patrick's deep calm and unquestioning stare and assumed the boy was in shock. He wanted Patrick to take a pill. Patrick didn't mind. It was diagnosed as crib death. Years later, there might have been questions about such a fatality, deviations from the usual infant death syndrome observed. But when it happened, the death was simply noted and the baby buried. Patrick was gratified that once things finally settled down, his meals began to come on time again. In the madness of that afternoon and evening, people banging in and out of the house, the red lights of the home hospital ambulance pulsing on the walls, Mrs. Hochstetter screaming and wailing and refusing to be comforted, only Patrick's father came within brushing distance of the truth. He was standing numbly by Avery's empty crib some 20 minutes after the body had been removed, simply standing there, unable to believe any of this had happened. He looked down and saw a pair of tracks on the hardwood floor. They had been made by the snow melting off Patrick's yellow rubber boots. He looked at them, and a dreadful thought rose briefly in his mind like bad gas from a deep mine shaft. His hand went slowly to his mouth, and his eyes widened. A picture began to form in his mind. Before it could come clear, he left the room, slamming the door behind him so hard that the top of the frame splintered. He never asked Patrick any questions. Patrick had never done anything like that again, although he might have done so if the chance had presented itself. He felt no guilt, had no bad dreams. As time passed, however, he became more aware of what would have happened to him if he had been caught. There were rules. Unpleasant things happened to you if you didn't follow them, or if you were caught breaking them. You could be locked up or stuck in the electrocution chair. But that remembered feeling of excitement, that feeling of color and sensation, was simply too powerful and too wonderful to give over entirely. Patrick killed flies. At first he only smacked them with his mother's fly swatter. Later he discovered he could kill them quite efficiently with a plastic ruler. He also discovered the joys of fly paper. A long sticky runner of it could be purchased for 2 cents at the Costello Avenue market, and Patrick sometimes stood for as long as 2 hours in the garage, watching the flies land and then struggle to get free, his mouth ajar, his dusty eyes alight with that rare excitement, sweat running down his round face and his thick body. Patrick killed beetles, but if possible, he captured them first. Sometimes he would steal a long needle from his mother's pincushion, impale a Japanese beetle on it, and sit cross-legged in the garden watching it die. His expression at these times was the expression of a boy who was reading a very good book. Once he had discovered a run-over cat that was dying in the gutter on Lower Main Street and sat watching it until an old woman saw him pushing the squashed and mewing thing around with his foot. She whacked him with the broom she had been using to sweep her walk. "Go on home," she had shouted at him. "What are you, crazy?" Patrick had gone on home. He wasn't mad at the old woman. He had been caught breaking the rules, that was all. Then last year, it would not have surprised Mike Hanlon or any of the others at that point to have known that it was, in fact, on the same day that George Denbrough had been murdered. Patrick had discovered the rusty Amana refrigerator, one of the larger dumpoids in the belt surrounding the dump itself. Like Bev, he had heard the cautionary warnings about such abandoned appliances, about how 30 squirty million kids got their stupid selves smoked in them each year. Patrick had stood looking at the refrigerator for a long time, idly playing pocket pool with himself. That excitement was back, stronger than it had ever been, except for the time he had fixed Avery. The excitement was back because, in the chilly yet fuming wastes that passed for his mind, Patrick Hockstetter had had an idea. The Luces, who lived 3 houses down from the Hockstetters, missed their cat, Bobby, a week later. The Luce kids, who couldn't remember a time when Bobby hadn't been there, spent hours combing the neighborhood for him. They even pooled their money and put an ad in the Derry News Lost and Found column. Nothing came of it. And if any of them had seen Patrick that day, bulkier than ever in his mothball-smelling winter parka, after the floodwaters receded in that fall of 57, it had come off bitterly cold almost at once, carrying a cardboard carton, they would have thought nothing of it. The Engstroms, a block over and almost directly behind the Hockstetter home, lost their cocker pup about 10 days before Thanksgiving. Other families lost dogs and cats over the next 6 or 8 months, and Patrick, of course, had taken them all, not to mention a dozen unremarked strays from the Hell's Half-Acre area of Derry. He put them into the rusty Amana near the dump, one by one. Each time he brought another animal down, his heart thundering in his chest, his eyes hot and watery with excitement, he would expect to find that Mandy Fazio had pulled the Amana's latch or popped the hinges with his sledgehammer. But Mandy never touched that particular refrigerator. Perhaps he didn't realize it was there. Perhaps the force of Patrick's will kept him away. Or perhaps some other force did that. The Engstrom's cocker lasted the longest. In spite of the single number cold, it was still alive when Patrick came back for the 3rd time in as many days. Although it had lost all of its friskiness, it had been wagging its tail and lapping his hands frantically when he originally hauled it out of the box and stuffed it into the refrigerator. When he came back a day after putting it in, the puppy had damn near gotten away. Patrick had to chase it almost all the way to the dump before he was able to jump it and get hold of one rear leg. The puppy had nipped Patrick with its sharp little teeth. Patrick didn't mind. In spite of the nips, he had taken the cocker back to the refrigerator and bundled it back in. He had a hard-on when he did it. This was not uncommon. On the second day, the puppy had tried to get out again, but it moved much too slowly. Patrick shoved it back in, slammed the Amana's rusty door, and leaned against it. He could hear the puppy scratching against the door. He could hear its muffled whines. "Good dog," said Patrick Hochstetter. His eyes were closed and he was breathing fast. "That's a good dog." On the third day, the puppy could only roll its eyes toward Patrick's face when the door opened. Its sides were heaving rapidly and shallowly. When Patrick returned the next day, the cocker was dead with a cake of foam frozen around its mouth and muzzle. This made Patrick think of coconut popsicles, and he laughed quite hard as he hauled the frozen corpse from his killing bottle and threw it in the bushes. The supply of victims, which Patrick thought of, when he thought of them at all, as test animals, had been thin this summer. Questions of reality aside, his sense of self-preservation was well developed, his intuition exquisite. He suspected he was suspected. By whom, he was not sure. Mr. Engstrom? Perhaps. Mr. Engstrom had turned around and given Patrick a long, speculative look in the A&P one day this spring. Mr. Engstrom had been buying cigarettes and Patrick had been sent for bread. Mrs. Josephs? Maybe. She sat in her parlor window with a telescope sometimes and was, according to Mrs. Hochstetter, a nosy Parker. Mr. Jacobois, who had an ASPCA sticker on the back bumper of his car? Mr. Nell? Someone else? Patrick didn't know for sure, but his intuition told him he was suspected, and he never argued with his intuition. He had taken a few wandering animals from among the rotted tenements in the half acre, picking only those that looked thin or diseased, but that was all. He discovered, however, that the refrigerator near the dump had gotten an oddly powerful hold over him. He began to draw pictures of it in school when he was bored. He sometimes dreamed of it at night, and in his dreams the Amana was perhaps 70 feet tall, a whited sepulcher, a ponderous crypt iced in chilly moonlight. In these dreams, the giant door would swing open and he would see huge eyes staring out at him. He would awake in a cold sweat, but he found he could not give up the joys of the refrigerator entirely. Today, he had finally found out who had suspected. Bowers. Knowing that Henry Bowers held the secret of his killing bottle in his hands left Patrick as close to panic as he was ever apt to get. This was not very close at all, in truth, but he still found this, not fear exactly, but mental unrest, oppressive and unpleasant. Henry knew that Patrick sometimes broke the rules. His latest victim had been a pigeon he discovered on Jackson Street 2 days ago. The pigeon had been struck by a car and couldn't fly. Patrick went home, got his box out of the garage, and put the pigeon inside. The pigeon pecked the back of Patrick's hand several times, leaving shallow, bloody digs. Patrick didn't mind. When he checked the refrigerator the next day, the pigeon had been quite dead. But Patrick hadn't removed the corpse then. Now, following Henry's threat to tell, Patrick decided he better get rid of the pigeon's body right away. Perhaps he would even get a bucket of water and some rags and scrub out the interior of the refrigerator. It didn't smell very good. If Henry told and Mr. Nell came down to check, he might be able to tell that something, several somethings, in fact, had died in there. If he tells, Patrick thought, standing in the grove of pines and looking at the rusty Amana, I'll tell that he broke Eddie Kasprak's arm. Of course, they probably knew that already, but they couldn't prove anything because all of them said they had been playing out at Henry's house that day, and Henry's crazy father had backed them up. But if he tells, I'll tell, tit for tat. Never mind that now. What he had to do now was get rid of the bird. He would leave the refrigerator door open and then come back with the rags and the water and clean it up. Good. Patrick opened the refrigerator door on his own death. At first, he was simply puzzled, unable to cope in any way with what he was seeing. It meant nothing to him at all. It had no context. Patrick merely stared, his head cocked to one side, his eyes wide. The pigeon was nothing but a skeleton surrounded by a ragged fall of feathers. There was no flesh left on its body at all. And around it, stuck on the refrigerator's inner walls, hanging from the underside of the freezer compartment, dangling from the wire shelves, were dozens of flesh-colored objects that looked like big macaroni shells. Patrick saw that they were moving slightly, fluttering, as if in a breeze. Except there was no breeze. He frowned. So Suddenly, one of the shell-like things unfurled insectile wings. Before Patrick could do more than register the fact, it had flown across the space between the refrigerator and Patrick's left arm. It struck with a smacking sound. There was an instant of heat. It faded, and Patrick's arm felt just like always again. But the shell-like creature's pale flesh turned first pink, and then, with shocking suddenness, rose red. Although Patrick was afraid of almost nothing in the commonly understood sense of the word, it's hard to be afraid of things that aren't real, there was at least one thing that filled him with wretched loathing. He had come out of Brewster Lake one warm August day when he was 7 to discover 4 or 5 leeches clinging to his stomach and legs. He had screamed himself hoarse until his father had pulled them off. Now, in a deadly burst of inspiration, he realized that this was some weird kind of flying leech. They had infested his refrigerator. Patrick began to scream and beat at the thing on his arm. It had swelled to nearly the size of a tennis ball. At the third blow, it broke open with a sickening squat sound. Blood, his blood, sprayed his arm from elbow to wrist. But the thing's jelly-like eyeless head held on. In a way, it was like a bird's narrow head, ending in a beak-like structure. But this beak was not flat or pointed. It was tubular and blunt, like the proboscis of a mosquito. This proboscis was buried in Patrick's arm. Still screaming, he pinched the splattered creature between his fingers and pulled it off. The proboscis came out cleanly, followed by a watery flow of blood mixed with some yellowish-white liquid like pus. It had made a painless dime-sized hole in his arm. And the creature, although exploded, was still twisting and moving and seeking in his fingers. Patrick threw it away, turned, and more of them flew out of the refrigerator, lighting on him even as he groped for the Amana's handle. They landed on his hands, his arms, his neck. One touched down on his forehead. When Patrick raised his hand to pick it off, he saw 4 others on his hand, trembling minutely, turning first pink and then red. There was no pain, but there was a hideous draining sensation. Screaming, whirling, beating at his head and neck with his leech-encrusted hands, Patrick Hochstetter's mind yammered, "It isn't real. It's just a bad dream. Don't worry. It's not real. Nothing is real." But the blood pouring from the smashed leeches seemed real enough. The sound of their buzzing wings seemed real enough, and his own terror seemed real enough. One of them fell down inside his shirt and settled on his chest. While he was beating frantically at it and watching the blood stain spread above the place where it had taken its hold, another settled on his right eye. Patrick closed it, but that did no good. He felt a brief hot flare as the thing's sucker poked through his eyelid and began to suck the fluid out of his eyeball. Patrick felt his eye collapse in its socket, and he screamed again. A leech flew into his mouth when he did and roosted on his tongue. It was all almost painless. Patrick went staggering and flapping up the path toward the junked cars. Parasites hung all over him. Some of them drank to capacity and then burst like balloons. When this happened to the bigger ones, they drenched Patrick with almost 1/2 pint of his own hot blood. He could feel the leech inside his mouth swelling up, and he opened his jaws because the only coherent thought he had left was that it must not burst in there. It must not. But it did. Patrick ejected a huge spray of blood and parasite flesh-like vomit. He fell down in the gravelly dirt and began to roll over and over, still screaming. Little by little, the sound of his own screams began to seem faint, far away. Just before he passed out, he saw a figure step from behind the last of the junked cars. At first, Patrick thought he was a guy, Mandy Fazio, perhaps, and he would be saved. But as the figure drew closer, he saw its face was running like wax. Sometimes it began to harden and look like something or someone, and then it would start to run again, as if it couldn't make up its mind who or what it wanted to be. "Hello and goodbye," a bubbling voice said from inside the running tallow of its features, and Patrick tried to scream again. He didn't want to die. As the only real person, he wasn't supposed to die. If he did, everyone else in the world would die with him. The man shape laid hold of his leech-encrusted arms and began to drag him away toward the barrens. His blood-stained book carrier bumped and thumped along beside him, its straps still twisted about his neck. Patrick, still trying to scream, lost consciousness. He awoke only once, when, in some dark, smelly, drippy hell where no light shone, no light at all, it began to feed. 6. At first, Beverly was not entirely sure what she was seeing or what was happening, only that Patrick Hochstetter had begun to thrash and dance and scream. She got up warily, holding the slingshot in one hand and 2 of the ball bearings in the other. She could hear Patrick blundering off down the path, still yelling his head off. In that moment, Beverly looked every inch the lovely woman she was going to become. And if Ben Hanscom had been around to see her just then, his heart might not have been able to stand it. She was standing fully upright, her head cocked to the left, her eyes wide, her hair done in braids that had been tied off with two small red velvet bows which she had bought at Dolly's for a dime. Her posture was one of total attention and concentration. It was feline, lynx-like. She had shifted forward on her left foot, her body half-turned as if to go after Patrick, and the legs of her faded shorts had pulled up enough to show the edging of her yellow cotton panties. Below them, her legs were already smoothly muscled, beautiful in spite of the scabs, bruises, and smutches of dirt. "It's a trick. He saw you, and he knows he probably can't catch you in a fair chase, so he's trying to get you to come out. Don't go, Bevy." But another part of her thought there was too much pain and fear in those screams. She wished she had seen whatever had happened to Patrick, if anything had, more clearly. She wished more than anything else that she had come into the Barrens a different way and missed the whole crazy shenanigans. Patrick's screams stopped. A moment later, Beverly heard someone speak. But she knew that had to be her imagination. She heard her father say, "Hello and goodbye." Her father wasn't even in Derry that day. He had set off for Brunswick at 8 o'clock. He and Joe Tamerley were going to pick up a Chevy truck in Brunswick. She shook her head as if to clear it. The voice didn't speak again. Her imagination, obviously. She walked out of the bushes to the path, ready to run the instant she saw Patrick charging at her, her reactions on triggers as delicate as a cat's whiskers. She looked down at the path, and her eyes widened. There was blood here, quite a lot of it. "Fake blood," her mind insisted. "You can buy a bottle of it at Dolly's for 49 cents. Be careful, Bevy." She knelt and quickly touched the blood with her fingers. She looked at them closely. It wasn't fake blood. There was a flash of heat in her left arm, just below the elbow. She looked down and saw something that she first thought was some kind of burr. No, not a burr. Burrs didn't twitch and flutter. This thing was alive. A moment after that, she realized it was biting her. She struck it hard with the back of her right hand, and it spattered, spraying blood. She backed up a step, getting ready to scream now that it was over. And then she saw that it wasn't over at all. The thing's featureless head was still on her arm, its snout buried in her flesh. With a shrill cry of disgust and fear, she picked it off and saw its proboscis come out of her arm like a small dagger, dripping with blood. She understood the blood on the path now, oh yes, and her eyes went to the refrigerator. The door had swung closed and latched again, but a number of parasites had been left outside and were crawling sluggishly over the rusty white porcelain. As Beverly looked, one of them unfurled its membranous fly-like wings and buzzed toward her. She acted without thinking, loading one of the steel ball bearings into the cup of the bullseye and pulling the sling back. As the muscles of her left arm flexed smoothly, she saw loose blood squirt from the hole the thing had made in her arm. She let fly anyway, unconsciously leading the flying thing. "Shit, missed," she thought as the bullseye snapped and the ball bearing flew, a glittering chunk of light in the hazy sun. And she would later tell the other losers that she knew she had missed it, the same way a bowler knows he has missed the strike as soon as a bad ball leaves his hand. But then she saw the ball bearing curve. It happened in a split second, but the impression was very clear. It had curved. It struck the flying thing and splattered it to mush,